Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank the organizers, Martin, Una, and Roger, for inviting me to this conference. I'm going to talk about interfacing hydrodynamics, ionization calculations, or more appropriately, non-equilibrium ionization calculations, and X-ray spectral codes for supernova remnants. The thing about the time machine is just a futile attempt on my part to make this topic sound remotely exciting. I have to thank my wonderful collaborators, without whose help this science would not be possible. You'll notice that even though this session is devoted to Cas-A, the remnant that I'm displaying here prominently is the Tycho supernova remnant. That is because the techniques that I'm going to describe have only been applied in detail to the Tycho supernova remnant. I will try to keep the discussion as general as possible, and I will specifically discuss what's needed for Cas-A at the end of the talk. Okay, the goal of this kind of studies is to use the excellent X-ray observations of young supernova remnants provided by the modern observatories, you know, Chandra and Exum and Newton, to learn about the physics of supernova explosion. And I'd like to stress that I'm going to discuss only X-ray emission from the shock ejecta. Many of the things that I will say will only apply to X-ray emission from the shock ejecta. So what is the best way to do this? Is there a simple approach? Well, it turns out the answer to that question is no. And often it's needed to couple hydrodynamic simulations to non-equilibrium ionization calculations. I'll discuss what the levels of sophistication in this kind of HT plus NEI schemes are, and what the tools of the trade are to take them to perform this kind of simulations, what's available out there publicly, and what you're probably going to have to build yourself if you're interested in this kind of thing. Then I'll go on to some considerations about the generation of synthetic X-ray spectra in half the time. Also, I will also try to discuss some of the issues that you might encounter if you try to compare this synthetic spectra to real data. And I hope by the end of the talk I might have convinced you that this HT plus NEI simulations are really a veritable time machine, and we can use them now to learn about what happened when the supernovae exploded hundreds of years ago. Okay, so here's the problem. On top we have whatever comes from the observations. This, for the X-rays, this usually takes the form of images, and here's again the Tycho supernova remnant, and spectra. This is the XMM spectrum also for the Tycho supernova remnant. And in this images and in this spectra, you see all these wonderful lines from oxygen, silicon, sulfur, argon, calcium, and iron. And at least in the case of the Tycho supernova remnant, all this line emission comes from the shock ejecta. So there are certainly some information here. On the other side, we have what we know from for supernovae, usually, you know, in the form of theoretical calculations. This here is a standard 1D model for a type 1A supernova. You have here composition as a function of Lagrangian mass coordinate, and also the density profile. So that's the structure of the ejecta, and this here is a snapshot from a 3D simulation. And now, how do you connect this with that? Well, there's essentially two approaches. You can go from the observations to the theory, and I'm going to call this just the observational approach. You analyze the X-ray observations and attempt to extract physical parameters that you can then relate to the theory of supernova explosions. Or you can do it the other way around. And I'm going to call this the theoretical approach. You start from the theory of supernova explosions, or what you think you know from supernova explosions, and then attempt to predict, or speaking more accurately, post-dict the X-ray emission from the supernova remnants. Now, and over the next slides, I will show you why I think that there are severe limitations to this approach, and that this theoretical road looks a lot more promising for making progress. Okay. Now, at the core of the problem is the fact, the well-known fact, that we're dealing with transient plasmas. Okay, ionization is a collisional process, and if density is high enough, this means that collisional ionization equilibrium will set in, and I've illustrated this here for silicon. Essentially, what you have is that for each electron temperature, you have determined what the amount of each ion that you're going to have. The problem is that in supernova remnants, the density is never high enough for this, and the ionization state is always evolving. So besides the electron temperature, another variable comes in, and this is the ionization timescale that some people call fluence, defined as the product of the electron number, density of electrons, and the time. If you have density and you have time, that means dynamics. And essentially what I'm telling you here, and this is inescapable, is that the dynamics of the remnant, the hydrodynamic evolution, is going to determine the ionization state, and through it, the X-ray emission. So these things are coupled, and you cannot disentangle one from the other. In the shock ejecta, the situation is actually even worse, because the plasma in the shock ejecta is chemically inhomogeneous. And it's chemically inhomogeneous because it bears the imprint of the supernova explosion. And that is precisely what we're interested in. So since you expect a distribution of ionization timescales and temperatures within the shock plasma, there is going to be that superimposed on the inhomogeneity of the plasma, and therefore you're going to have different elements emitting X-rays under different conditions. And I've illustrated this here for a 1D calculation. You can see that the emission measure average electron temperature and ionization timescale for different elements in the shock ejecta vary with time and are different. Okay. So the problem with the observational approach is that it's often based on simple spectral models with variable abundances. I say simple here because the models are simple compared to reality, but they're actually very complex. They're among the most complex models that you can find in X-ray packages like XSPEC. And I've put here just a few examples. And the problem with these models is that they're not adequate for ejecta emission. And if you read this paper by Kajet Borkowski where he puts these models forward and describes them, he is very specific about that. These models are not adequate for ejecta emission for several reasons. First, they always assume that the plasma is chemically homogeneous, and we have seen that's not true. Then when they assume some kind of shock dynamics, it's always simplified. In the best case, it's going to be a plane shock. And last but not least, these three for sure, and most models that people apply, have the solar composition plasma hardwired into them. That means you can vary the abundances, but the model's always assuming that the electron pool is dominated by hydrogen and helium. Okay, so even if a given model provides a good fit to the data, and if you've tried using these models for real cases, you know that's easier said than done. But even if you do get a fit, the fitted parameters, which are usually electron temperatures and ionization timescale and elemental abundances, which is what we are interested in, they're very hard to interpret. And this is discussed to some extent in a paper that Kara Rokoski has just submitted. It is, of course, possible to use simple models to gain some understanding of small regions where these two issues here are not so important. But you still have that to deal with. And even if you achieve that limited understanding, these results have to be put in the context of some model for the dynamics of the remnant. And Martin and Una did a very nice example of this in these two papers. So the thing that I want to get through to you, though, is that since these fitted parameters are not reliable, the only way to understand the X-ray emission from the shock ejecta in young supernova remnants globally, and when I say globally, I mean from the spatially integrated spectrum to the large-scale spatial variations of the X-ray emission, down to the small scales that only Chandra can resolve, is through hydrodynamic simulations coupled to non-equilibrium ionization calculations and an X-ray emission code. Okay, so how do you do this? There's two very complex things that you have to deal with. First is the events leading to the explosion. There is a progenitor system for the supernova that during the time that leads to the explosion will modify its circumstellar medium through several mass loss processes that could be stellar winds or binary evolution or whatnot. And then there's the supernova explosion itself, which is a result of this pre-supernova evolution. And the physical processes that take part during the explosion, and in particular the nucleosynthesis, are going to give you the structure of the supernova ejecta. Now, the supernova explodes in its circumstellar medium, and these two things interact, and you have the hydrodynamic interaction. And we've been hearing a lot during the past days about how this hydrodynamic interaction is very complex for supernova remnants. I've divided this rather arbitrarily into these two boxes. You have the shock physics, which by which I mean, you know, anything that's going at the shocks. And Don Allison discussed how the shocks in supernova remnants accelerate cosmic rays, and that certainly has an influence on the dynamics of the remnant. Then Parviz talked a little bit yesterday, and Kara's is going to discuss some more today about the fact that there's collisional with electron heating, which is also important. And then you have whatever is going on inside the shock plasma, non-equilibrium ionization and Coulomb collisions, or you know, the elastic collisions, are the two main processes here. But there's also other things going on. You have radiative losses and ionization losses and thermal conduction, and these three processes can, in their own turn, influence the hydrodynamics. So there's the possibility of having a certain feedback here. If you can make sense of any of this, then you can calculate the X-ray emission. But this is really every bit as complex as it seems. And it's a very unclean problem because there's no obvious way to isolate any of those physical processes and study it under idealized conditions. And, you know, so our theoretical understanding of young supernova remnants is not complete. And therefore, the simulations that we do must be incomplete also. And approximations are necessary. The name of the game, of course, is to identify which approximations are reasonable for each object. Okay? Then I'll talk a little bit about hydrodynamic codes. First thing to note is that there is no universal hydrodynamic code that will do everything. Vikram once said that, you know, this is like expecting a telescope that observes at all wavelengths perfectly. That's not going to happen. All hydrocodes are very similar to each other in the sense that they fundamentally solve the same equations. They solve the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy, give or take a few sources or sinks here. But there are important differences. And one difference that's crucial from what I'm discussing here is that hydrocodes can be Lagrangian, when the mesh is fixed to the material, or Eulerian, where the mesh is not fixed to the material. It could be moving in space or fixed in space, but it's not fixed to the material. And this is important because these guys here, they're good for following composition-dependent processes. If you're calculating a supernova explosion, that would be nucleosynthesis. If you're calculating the evolution of a supernova remnant, that would be ionization or radiative cooling. And these guys here, they're, for technical reasons that I will not discuss, they're good for spatial accuracy. Most multidimensional codes are usually Eulerian. So obviously you have a problem here. This division is something that I like because it reminds me a lot of another division that I'm very fond of. And that's a division in the kinds of beer, you know? Beers are always either lagers or ales. And lager sounds a lot like Lagrangian, and ale sounds a lot like Eulerian. And it's not that one is better than the other. I mean, there's enormous variety within those two classes. But, well, that was just to have you a little break in the equator of the presentation. There's several publicly available hydrocodes that you can use, and you know, you can go to these websites and learn more about them. But even the simplest multidimensional hydrocodes are complex things, and you should expect a learning curve here. Okay, a little bit about non-equilibrium ionization calculations. Assuming that you have only two Maxwellian populations, one for ions and one for electrons, and this is indeed an approximation, turns out to be a pretty good one for shock ejecta, especially if you're looking at CCD spectra. You have two processes going on at the same time. There's the internal energy exchange through elastic collisions, Coulomb collisions between ions and electrons. It's going to modify the way the specific internal energy is distributed between the two populations. And then you have ionization and recombination, which are the inelastic collisions. You know, and in this equation, so the equations are not the important thing. The important thing to note is that here you have the density and the specific internal energy, and that's an input that you take from the hydrodynamics. So these processes are controlled by the hydrodynamics. And here you see an example. This is the hydrodynamic evolution of a fluid element that, you know, expands freely until it's overrun by the reverse shock, and then that's like this, and that's the specific internal energy. And here's how the ion and electron temperatures evolve inside inside this fluid element. Note that in this particular case, there's been collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock. And then you have the ionization of the species that are in this fluid element, and here I have put the example for silicon. The two things to note is that these two equations are coupled in shock ejecta because the number of electrons per ion, which appears here and there, changes with time. The plasma is not dominated by hydrogen and helium. And that the equations are stiff, meaning that the possibility of rapid variation on short timescales has to be taken into account. And numerically, I have I solve this with an implicit scheme, though there's several ways of doing that. The state equations are discussed in the numerical recipes book. You can look at that. And then there's feedback processes. I call them feedback processes because it's what goes on inside the shock plasma that can affect the hydrodynamics. The most obvious candidate is radiative losses. This is also a collisional process, so it will affect dense material, either because it was shocked early on, or which is usually the hallmark of a strong circumstellar interaction, and it has been shocked for a long time, so you need the material to be dense for a long time. These radiative losses are strongly dependent on ionization state and chemical composition, and they're a runaway process. So there is another stiff equation for you. I've illustrated this here with this cooling curve, which is totally wrong for supernova ejecta because it's in collisional ionization equilibrium and for solar composition, but this is the shape that it has. It has a low regime where the plasma can emit X-rays for a long time, but if it cools to the optical, it cools all the way because this is very steep. Then you have ionization losses, and these behave essentially like radiative losses, to the point that if you're in a situation where you don't have to worry about this, you probably don't have to worry about that either. And then there's thermal conduction. Now, thermal conduction is a very complex process. It's strongly dependent on magnetic field distribution and density inhomogeneities in the shock plasma, and the model predictions are usually hard to reconcile with the morphology of young supernova remnants. One thing with seen a lot about turbulent magnetic fields, especially yesterday, and in a turbulent magnetic field, thermal conduction becomes anisotropic and it's inhibited. So in some cases, the observations rule out efficient thermal conduction because you see a strong temperature gradient in the shock ejecta, but this is not always the case. Okay, if you can figure out what's going on inside the shock plasma, it turns out that calculating the X-ray spectrum is relatively easy because this is optically thin radiation. So what you see is what you get. This can be done directly in X-PEC, thanks to the efforts of people like Kazik Borkowski and Randall Smith. But there is something that you need to take into account, and that the atomic data for non-equilibrium ionization plasmas in the X-rays are incomplete. And this is an understatement. Okay? You have to be very conservative about what you trust from a synthetic X-ray spectrum calculation. Here I'm comparing two particular spectral codes. This is NEI version 1.1 from XSPEC versus a modified version of 2.0. And just judge for yourself. The underlying model is exactly the same, and the differences are huge. There's things like RNK alpha, which are pretty well established. But this kind of thing, this is horrible. There's no other way of explaining it. It doesn't make sense to spend so many millions on X-ray satellites if the tools you need to interpret the observations are not readily available. And this is not a fault of the people that work here, that work in this. It's just that there is no funding for things like that. And also, comparing the synthetic spectra with data in a quantitative way is often not easy. Okay. So how did I apply this to the Tycho supernova remnant? Well, by making approximations, of course. We're pretty sure this is a type 1A, so we concentrated on type 1A models, and we evolved them inside a constant ambient medium density. I don't have time to explain why we consider this a good approximation. It agrees with the observation. We assume that there are no radiative ionization losses because the optically emitting ejector are just not there. And no thermal conduction because there is a strong thermal gradient inside the shock ejecta. So this basically gets rid of the feedback processes, and you can run the hydro and then do the ionizations. And there's not so reasonable approximations like ignoring the cosmic ray acceleration. This is outrageously wrong for the forward shock, but it's actually okay for the shock ejecta. And doing the simulations with spherical symmetry. If you want, all the details are here in a paper, which is an AstroPH. And this is an example model. Okay, here you have the structure of the ejecta. You calculate the hydrodynamics, and here I'm showing the shock ejecta between the contact discontinuity and reverse shock. It's the density, the specific internal energy. And here you see ionization state, mean ionization state, the electron temperatures, depending on whether there is not or there is collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock, and the ionization timescales. So you do have a distribution of conditions, and superimposed on that distribution of conditions, you have the chemical stratification of the ejecta model. So different elements are emitting under different conditions, and this is very important for the spectra that you generate. Okay, I have no time for this, and I have no time for that. But okay, to the point. So you calculate out this synthetic spectra, and then you compare them to the observations. And what do you see? Well, we found out that it's actually possible to establish pretty good connections between the observations and the models, and it's only the late detonation type 1a supernova explosion models that can explain the fundamental properties of the X-ray emission from all the elements in the shock ejector. Oxygen, silicon, sulfur, argon, calcium, and iron. Everything that's a delayed detonation consistently works very well. Everything that's not a late detonation consistently doesn't work well at all. And you see here, this is the non-thermal emission from the shock damming medium. Not just any power law, but the power law with the index. So that's determined from high energy observations. And this is the ejecta model. There's the only two components in the fit. This is the best 1D deflagration, not good. Best 3D deflagration, not good. And the best sub-Chandrasekhar explosion, not good at all. And the good thing about this kind of analysis is that this is not just a spectral model. It has an underlying physical model. So things like positions of the forward shocks for the right distance to the remnant and velocity of the shock ejector are reproduced actually pretty well. I'd also like to say that this is extremely hard because you're working with very good spectra, very high signal-to-noise here, and the lines are very well defined. So it's quite different from you know just plotting a line through a graph that has a few points with error bars. That you're very, very much constrained by the observations. Okay. So how do you do this for a core collapse supernova remnant? Up here, two type 1a supernova remnants, Tycho and SN1006. Down here, two core collapse supernova remnants, Casse and G292. Thermonuclear supernovae are straightforward explosions, not simple, straightforward. We know how they work. And they lead to relatively simple dynamics. Core collapse explosions are a lot more complex, and they lead to more complex dynamics. So what I'm trying to get through to you is that core collapse supernova remnants are more challenging than thermonuclear supernova remnants in general. And Chris Fryer put that beautifully to me on Monday. He said, type 1As are for wimps. Okay. Core collapse supernovae are not so well understood, and we've heard a little bit about this through the conference. Theoretical models still do not explode, though Adam Burrows showed something that might work in the long run. The parameter space is very large, and the relationship between explosion physics and ejecta structure is less direct. And Amy talked about this a little bit. In particular, the nucleosynthesis is not instrumental for the explosion. In type 1a's, the nucleosynthesis is the explosion. In type 2's, nucleosynthesis is a side effect of the explosion. Supernova remnant dynamics, therefore, are going to be more complex. The ejecta are more turbulent and anisotropic. We know that both from the observations and from the simulations. And the progenitors can strongly modify their circumstellar median. And, you know, Stefan showed how these supernovae usually show up in the X-rays. And the supernova remnant evolution in the circumstellar medium can be dramatically different from what it is in a constant ambient medium. And Vikram also discussed this. So what is needed for Casse? Okay, I'm afraid I don't have very good news here. There's this obviously strong asymmetries in the ejecta of Casse. We know this from the abundance pattern and jet is a little bit of a taboo word. So, well, the asymmetry in the, or whatever this is, and this was the jet counterjet or however you want to call it, was found out by Jaco, and Martin has discussed this. So it's inescapable. You're going to need some kind of multidimensional hydrodynamic simulation here. But there is more. There is conspicuous optical emission from radiatively cooled ejecta. So the feedback processes have to be taken into account. Okay, this is a very complex problem. And the technical aspects of the simulations will be crucial to be successful here. The initial configuration will require a lot of attention, and this is why, you know, analysis like the one we heard in the excellent talk by Patrick Young earlier this morning are very important, because just the range of initial models is just too large. Due to these two things, you know, a global approach might not be the best choice at first. However, if we expect to understand this, the only way to do it globally is through this hydrodynamic plus non-equilibrium ionization simulations. And with that, I will stop.
Okay, questions or comments for Carlos?
Carlos, you mentioned all the difficulties in modeling all this. I think you glossed over one important one, though, which was the structure of the ejecta itself, which you didn't really talk about in detail.
I attempted to sneak a little bit over that because I would have had to talk a lot about type 1 supernova models, which is not really the issue.
Yeah, no, but I don't want to go into the model themselves, but I'm saying if you don't have a good ejecta model, like we know that for type 1As, there's quite a few different ones.
Yes.
How much does that affect your final answer? I mean, have you checked that?
It affects it completely. In fact, that's the thing that's remarkable. If you use some different ejecta models, the X-ray emission you get out is so different that it's actually pretty easy to tell from the observations what kind of explosion you have. Okay, I really went too fast over that. I had 32 different type 1A supernova explosion models for the Tycho supernova.
32.
All of them different. Delay detonations, 1D deflagrations, 3D deflagrations, sub-chandrasekhar explosions, pulsating delay detonations. And, you know, tried all of them and treat them all on an equal basis. Everything that is not a delay detonation is very different from the data. Everything that's a delay detonation looks very similar to the data.
Yeah, my question more was then getting into, like, how much degeneracy is there? Do you think you can actually say, okay, I can use this model and get this answer, it's actually valid, or do you think that I can use another model and get the same answer?
Okay, it's, as I try to show, you know, you're really very much constrained by the observations. Those spectra are really very good. So if you expect the model to reproduce roughly the centroids and flux line ratios from all the elements, there's not that much of a choice. There is certain degeneracy within the delay detonation models, but everything that's not a delay detonation just does not manage to reproduce the fundamental constraints. And this is a very robust result.
And these are all 1D models?
These are all 1D models. And that's the reason why I'm not being very assertive about, you know, the best delay detonation that we find. You know, that might change if you do a more complex or a more detailed analysis. But the fact that delay detonations work and everything else does not work, doesn't even come close, that is very robust.
So do you think that from these things you could actually, maybe in future at least, go back and try to tell what the explosion models were which best fit? Like, you think you'd be able to make a conclusive statement? Just from looking at the spectra and trying to fit them, that you could.
Well, I think make a conclusive
statement. You're
saying
now delay detonation. Do you think you could even take separate models or something from different groups? Do you think you would?
What do you mean separate models from different?
I mean, different
groups?
Models from different groups do delay detonation, and they still come
okay.
up with a slightly different.
I really, really went fast over that. In that, those three spectra that I showed. Let me go back to it. Okay. Getting there. Come on. Okay, it's the next one after that. Okay, this is a delay detonation model that my advisor calculated. But this 3D deflagration model was calculated by the Munich group. And this 1D deflagration model is the famous W7 model calculated by Kent.
But even the 3D deflagration, you took a 1D slice, or you actually can do
No. You have to take a 1D average.
Yeah.
It's not a slice, it's a 1D average. Yeah, but the main property of 3D deflagrations is that the ejecta are well mixed. So wherever you have iron, you have silicon. In this data, you see silicon and iron emitting X-rays under different conditions. There is no way a 3D deflagration is going to work. No way. Unless you manage to convince silicon to emit different from its neighbor.
Yeah, but what I was getting into more was also like that there are some. Sorry, am I taking? There are also there are models like with flash and stuff and all where they are completely asymmetric, and you'd have to take the 3D structure, the 1D
wouldn't
work. Yeah,
there's no way to take all different models into account.
No.
And
I'm saying you have to take the 3D structure, not all different.
You're talking about the gravitational confined detonation by Tomek Kluwer. Okay,
yeah,
and yeah, no, I mean that's very interesting. But there's one thing in the Tycho supernova remnant. Okay, the ejecta emission is very homogeneous. There is some iron-rich stuff here, but the level of inhomogeneity in the ejecta emission here and there are totally different. I mean, you take slices of the ejecta emission and the properties are the same. There cannot be large-scale anisotropies in this in the Tiger supernova realm. And there cannot be large-scale anisotropies in type 1As either. Because if there were large-scale anisotropies, they would not be standardizable candles.
Any other questions or comments?
So how sensitive are you for the to the shock compression ratio for Tycho?
Okay, in the case of the shock ejecta, and I try to be very specific about this. In the case of the shock ejecta, I do not think there can be cosmic ray acceleration at the at the reverse shock for several reasons. There is a theoretical argument that you need magnetic field for that, and you would not expect a lot of magnetic field inside ejecta that are basically expanding freely before they get hit by the reverse shock. Then there's the observations. The reverse shock in Tycho is traced by very, very hot and bright RNK alpha emission. Is, as Don explained, if you have a cosmic ray modified shock, what you get is higher compression ratios and lower temperatures. So that would be very, very hard to reconcile. And also, Jessica has showed that while the contact discontinuity is right on top of the forward shock, the distance between the reverse shock and the contact discontinuity is actually quite large. So it doesn't look like there's a high compression ratio there, or that the plasma is very cool.
But at the forward shock it could be. But how sensitive are you? Can you just?
Oh, at the forward shock, I made no model for the forward shock. I just took
but,
the.
But it is folded in your spectrum. When you
oh, yeah.
it, you have to include it, I guess.
Of course, you have to include it. No. I can manage to get that to you. Okay. What I did for the non-thermal emission, I took the power law of the measured at high energies. I just put it together with the ejecta emission. Now, if the ejecta emission does not allow the observed flux from non-thermal from the non-thermal emission, then you have an indication that model is probably not good.
And most of the from the forward shock. You don't really have just thermal continuum, that the non-thermal continuum
there
dominates?
There might be thermal emission from the shock dummy medium Tycho supernova remnant, but if there is, it's extremely faint. This is seen very nicely in Jessica's paper. It's there, it's extremely faint. You just do not see any. You see the thin rim, this is the thin rim from the non-thermal emission, and as you go inward, when you start seeing lines, they come from the ejecta. So it's actually a nice situation because the way things are conspire to make this possible. The physics of the forward shock emission is very complicated, but the emission is very simple. It's a power law. Whereas the physics of the shock ejecta is very simple, but the spectrum is very complicated because it's thermal. So the simplicity of one lets you constrain better the other.
Okay, any other questions? If not, let's thank Carlos again. Thank you. Right, our next talk is by